Welcome to Beyond the Spin. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the issues that are important to our communities during the 2012 election season. We'll be going beyond the headlines, beyond the horse race, and beyond the spin to get to the heart of the issues that have the most impact on all of our lives. We will be bringing together community journalists in a national conversation on the air, linking the stories and voices of diverse communities around the United States. As public radio journalists, we seek to bring the interest and opinions of communities that are often left out of the national broadcast landscape to the airwaves. We are building this new show as a dialogue, a conversation between communities about the future of our nation, with people from all parts of the country sharing their unique perspectives. There are plenty of other places to hear the pundits from inside the D.C. Beltway, but Beyond the Spin will feature voices from all the diverse communities that make up our country. We spent this week talking to people about the Republican National Convention as it took place in Tampa, Florida. We spoke with journalists inside the convention to get their first-hand account and analysis. We also spoke with journalists in different parts of the country who did not travel to Tampa to get their perspective on how the message the Republicans were looking to get out to the voting public translated in their communities. We had a chance to delve into the key issues for different parts of our population and whether the major parties are addressing them or not. First, let's go inside the convention center. I spoke with Margaret Prescott, host and producer of Sojourner Truth on KPFK in Los Angeles, and with Davey D., host of Hard Knock Radio on KPFA in Berkeley, California. I asked Margaret to start off by telling me who they've been interviewing and what they've been seeing.
Well, I spent some time talking to Republican women, right, because last night was, you know, women's night, so to speak, with a big speech from Ann Romney, and it was really interesting because first of all, I talked to a black woman who turned out to be from Barbados, which is where I'm from, and she is a staunch Republican Christian fundamentalist, right? And so she, you know, had her say and was very defensive in terms of her support for the Republican Party and about how people just shouldn't support Obama just because he's a black man, even though she did admit that there were some members of her family that she was fighting with about this. A number of the other women I spoke to, they were very interested in supporting mothers. You know, the whole slap about Ann Romney, you know, whether or not being a mom is working because she raised five sons. Now, she claimed she didn't have any servants, but I think if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. But they were going on about that. But then when I said, well, okay, well, what about low-income mothers, like mothers on welfare? They were completely confused. They didn't know how to come back to that because they had already talked about how, yes, moms should be supported and work so hard and whatnot. So that was really interesting, you know, for me. And that's, so I spent some time yesterday doing that and also talking to a few young people, and one young Asian woman I spoke to was actually a Ron Paul supporter, and she was an alternate delegate from Texas. And she was really interesting because she started out talking about how she was a conservative and a fiscal conservative, and turned out she's really strongly anti-war, right, and really into Ron Paul and was quite put out with what happened with Ron Paul yesterday. So Davey D, I know, has been out and talking to, you know, a whole set of other folks, but it's really interesting. I must say it's almost like, you know, it's like parallel worlds, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
This one, and then there's the real one.
I want to come back to pull out some of the things you were just talking about, but Davey D, what have you been covering? Where have you been around the convention or outside of it even?
I think, you know, in many ways it's a typical convention. And what they've done differently is I think they've insulated themselves from whatever protests are going on. The protests have been smaller than the ones that I've gone to in the past, and I mean, I've been going to conventions since 92, 96. So I remember larger, much, much larger demonstrations and all that. I think the usual issues are being raised around xenophobia, racism, the economy, you know, economic disparities, all that sort of stuff. Whether or not marching outside a convention hall that that has used $50 million of taxpayer money to outfit the police, shut down entire sections of Tampa, block off freeways, and pretty much create these huge buffer zones where you can barely get close to where the action is and where the people who are in power are at. Remains to be seen if that's an effective way of going about doing things. But people have been out here, you know, speaking truth to power, and inside here it's just the ultimate show of shows. You know, everybody's following a script, and the only people that were outside that script were the Ron Paul folks who we all seen get shafted.
And that's what you were talking about a moment ago, Margaret. Was the Ron Paul delegates that you've been talking to? I mean, they did put up something of a fight, but it was really squashed. I mean, what's your analysis of what you saw about that dynamic between them and the rest of the Republican convention?
Well, I don't think it was as sparse as perhaps the mainstream media is reporting. I mean, Mitch Jezrich, one of our team here, he was actually on the floor when the protest broke out, and I mean, people were standing up and loudly booing, right? It wasn't like a quiet kind of thing. I mean, it was really, you know, some tense moments going on there, and I don't know how much of that has really gotten out. And prior to that, there were about 10,000 or so Ron Paul supporters at an event just the other night. This was before the convention actually started.
In the rain,
okay? Yeah. And so there's a lot of passion there, and it's not over yet, because there is some talk about Ron Paul's supporters turning their backs when Mitt Romney speaks. Hmm. And actually, Ron Paul's supporters, after booing and carrying on, they then walked out. So there's a lot of tension going on. And, of course, Ron Paul, who has now said he's not endorsing Mitt Romney, you know, that also says something. So this is a fight that's gonna continue. You know, personally, my view is all that's well and good. I'm glad they're anti-war, but with Ron Paul and his son Rand Paul's position, somebody who's African American like myself, they would be ready to say, no, you don't have to serve her in your restaurant or allow her in your hotel. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have an issue, you know, with that, but just in terms of what is happening here, it's not over yet.
Well, there's one thing I would add. There's a big difference, I think, between Ron Paul and his son's politics.
That's true.
And the people that are out here. I think the reason why people need to be concerned is because those folks are young people that are out there that are coming of age and dealing with many of the problems that their predecessors, their fathers and uncles and elders have saddled them with, you know, economic disparities, lack of opportunity, and more importantly, how do you silence large voices? So the silencing of the Paul delegates, you know, forget Ron Paul for a minute, but
mm-hmm.
just these thousands of people who are out here who have a political stance. And for the most part, when you talk to them, their political stance is really around the war and drug wars and all that other stuff. That voice is being silenced, and that's why we definitely need to be concerned. The parallel to that is that criticism of the left that would raise these issues from a systemic standpoint and challenge the Democrats is also being silenced as well. It's being silenced in a different way. The way that that's happening is that you have punditry that have access to the microphone. They may look like you, they may sound like you, they may dress like you, but they just won't go there when it counts. And so you have a different type of more sophisticated silencing of the issue. And I'll bring up an example. The Malcolm X grassroots movement, we were talking about this earlier, put out a report in early July that, you know, they did a whole study and they showed that, you know, every 36 hours a black man or woman is being shot and killed by the police. That's outrageous.
Right.
And this is something that needs to be talked about, and it's something that resonates with a lot of people as we see questionable shootings coming up over and over again and no police to be held accountable. Well, when you look at your black punditry class, the ones that show up on MSNBC and all these CNN shows, they know this information, but they never, ever talk about it. They'll talk about Trayvon Martin. They'll talk about the Carter kid that was 21 years old and got shot. in the car, but they won't go there on a systemic level because it brings into account a lot of questions about maybe Obama, his administration, and folks that may live in some of these democratically run cities. But what are you doing about it? And so they tend to keep it in isolation, and then you have a whole layer of voices that are speaking and demanding accountability just on the basis of truth that are silent. So I see that parallel to what you're dealing with the Ron Paul, young people who have issues that are being silenced right here at this convention. And I anticipate that happening at the Democratic convention as well.
So, Margaret, when what David D. was just saying, I mean, are you seeing any kind of dissent among the voices of color inside the RNC or anybody else, or is this walking in lockstep beyond the dissenting voices of the Ron Paul delegates?
Yeah, well, the question, good question, or well put, because what voices of color are you talking about? I mean, there are a handful of black people running around here inside the convention hall from what I have seen, but really not that many. And if you look at the poll numbers and you see that among black people that Mitt Romney has 0% support, you know, that tells you something right here. So, you know, that is really what's going on. I mean, they do have their black folks. I think one just walked past me right now, Arthur, who's the one.
Arthur Davis.
Yeah. He's standing right across from us right now. And he helped to introduce Obama, you might recall, you know, last time. And this time, he's one of their black people at the convention. Him and Wycliffe Jean. Wycliffe Jean is going to be performing, if you would believe this. So, but they're just a handful of them. And you know how it is. Black folks are everywhere. No matter what is going on, you could go to Poland and go to some protest against the Polish government. You're going to find some black person up in there. You know what I'm saying? That's kind of how it feels here, like, you know, the RNC. So that's the thing. And the point that that Davey D was just making about the punditry, you know, I never really expect a whole lot out of the punditry. I'm always glad to see some, like, black faces out there because I figure at least a couple of things may come out that won't come out before. But they're really, you know, part of the establishment media as well. And I think that just as people kind of expected President Obama to be some kind of civil rights leader, he ain't no civil rights leader. He never was. He's a conservative, kind of a conservative guy, leader of the leading capitalist nation in the world. So, you know, why the big shock then about some of the things that he has not done? So I also think that we should hold the feet to the fire to the mainstream, not mainstream, but the main left, media outlet that also ignored the Malcolm X grassroots movement. I mean, I know some of these folks. John Nichols was with us. He's with The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, Alternet, Common Dreams, a whole lot. All of them ignored it also. You know, so the whole issue of race, you know, is also something that we have to be dealing with across the board. And I do think Davey D is right that we do have to hold people of color who are in any position of power, hold their feet to the fire, because you have a lot of civil rights leaders and a lot of black folks running around in the halls of power, but yet black people are poorer today than 30 years ago. And what is that about? But I think that we have to make a clean sweep if we're going to clean any of this mess up.
What both of you just said, I think this is. I think let's explore a bit more. I mean, I think that, you know, when you look at the electorate in America, that the majority of the African American community that votes will vote for Barack Obama, and a smaller majority of people from the Mexican American community and maybe even less than the Puerto Rican Dominican community will end up voting for Barack Obama. That will be clear and will happen, though there was a poll that we've been talking about with a lot of our other guests that we're exploring even in greater depth. There's a poll that was put out by Sussex University of the unlikely voters in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found of both registered and unregistered unlikely voters, it'll be up by 10 million to 90 million this year, back from 80 million 4 years ago. But that 43% of those people who are not voting would say, We're going to vote. If we were voting, we would vote for Barack Obama.
Yes.
Or 23% said if we were voting, we would vote third party.
Yes.
And 14% only said we would vote for Mitt Romney. So I'd like you both to explore for a minute what you see as the explanation of the contradictions in all of this and what you see going on. And whoever wants to start, Mark, why don't you start and then David D. jump in.
Yeah, well, I think that there is a lot of disillusionment. I think, you know, and I think the poll numbers are really reflecting that, and it remains to be seen if between now and Election Day there's going to be, you know, some change in that. I doubt that there's really going to be a whole lot of change, but I, you know, we were talking, David D., you'll remember the reverend we spoke to yesterday, a guest that you had on, and he was saying that, you know, if the President Obama's base doesn't turn out, basically, that Romney, Ryan are going to win. And that is something that we do have to seriously consider. So there's that argument on the one hand, and on the other hand, the argument that people, it's about time that people really started to seriously consider third-party candidates. My personal view on it, I mean, I can't say or who I'm voting for to suggest who people should be voting for, but a point that I made in that discussion yesterday is that it would be useful, I think, for the third-party candidates to, and they've begun to do some of this, to start running more seriously in local races like they've done in Richmond, California. If you look in Europe and you look in places like Germany, that's what they did over a number of years. And they kind of cut their teeth in these local elections, got some credibility, and now are on the national arena in terms of being taken seriously and having, you know, places in Parliament. But I'll be honest with you, a lot of black folks that are out there, and it's like, okay, go vote for, you know, Peace and Freedom Party. They may all support what Peace and Freedom Party stands for, but people are like, they don't have a hope in hell of winning, so why am I going to throw away my vote? You know, so there's still a lot of that, you know, going on. So I would hope that the third parties, so to speak, would really begin to put resources and focus into winning some of these local elections and showing people that they can win, okay? Because people want to go with a winner. Show people that they could win something and move forward from there. But I think Obama, there is going to be a challenge with pulling out the base. And I think that if black folks do not turn out in great numbers, if Latino people don't turn out in great numbers, if the women don't turn out in great numbers, President Obama is in serious trouble.
David D.?
Well, there's a couple of things. Let me take the last point first. I think we are turning out in good numbers, black and brown. The problem is that we keep focusing and we keep saying that we're not doing the job when really the racism that Margaret was speaking of is something that exists right there in that base. You know, in Wisconsin, the reason why Scott Walker won was because people that probably backed Obama or should have backed Obama didn't want to, they brought into the racism that was being put out there in that election. When you look at a place like Michigan where they were bailed out, you know, why did it turn Tea Party? Because a lot of those people simply turned their backs. It wasn't like people stayed home. A lot of people just said, I'm going with the other guy now. And I think that's something that we have to kind of deal with, and Obama as a candidate, along with the rest of that party, will have to figure out what they're going to do to appeal to them, while at the same time keeping some of the promises, which I don't think he's really made to us in the first place, but at least trying to do something that would give us a little bit of you know, encouragement. But the thing that I think we're not really focusing on is that it's not necessarily a left or right thing. It's a corporate thing. And both of these parties, at least in their high leadership, and even on the libertarian side, are beholden to big corporate dollars. And it's really that's where the fault line is. So when you saw the Ron Paul people get shafted, it was really the big corporate bigwigs. When you see the silencing on our side of town, it's really around this corporate, you know, entities and institutions that are having increasing sway over almost everything that we're doing. And how we battle that is going to be something that I think we're going to have long, hard conversations. So when we talk about Democrat and Republican and right and left, I'm really looking to see how deep in the pocket and how beholden are you to corporate interests. And you can see, even in our own background, how many of these civil rights organizations are beholden to the big corporations. You know, they're beholden to an AT&T, they're beholden to a Verizon, they're beholden to some of the big insurance companies that will turn around and shaft us in a minute when it comes to basic human rights. And that silencing that comes along with them funding some of these folks who are supposed to speak on our behalf is deafening. So that's a big challenge that I think we have. And when you come to these conventions, when you really look at it from that angle, it's pretty glaring and it's pretty obvious.
So before we have to roll out of here, I'm just to pick up on your last thought, David D., I'm curious how you and Margaret would explain what do you think the Pacifica Network and other progressive stations are getting out of being at the RNC, and what you're trying to find and what you're trying to ferret out for your listeners and others.
Well, I think, you know, that's a challenge. You know, I've been asked that, like, why are you all there? You know? And I think the ideal thing is that, you know, from my perspective as an outlet, you go to where the action is,
mm-hmm.
and you bring a perspective that will give people to think. I don't think it does us any good not to be there. At the same time, I think when we are here, we should raise up those voices and bring forth those perspectives and analysis that you normally would not hear. And what we need to do is go to other places with the same type of resources, the same type of vigor, and treat it the same way that we might treat this. So we should be at the Green Party or the Peace and Freedom Party conventions if and when they have them. We should be at the socialist conventions and all these other things the same way that we're here now, so that we treat them as important as we are treating this. This is the main stage. The whole world is watching these conventions. Of course you need to be here. I don't know that we get something out of it as much as it is that we should be reporting what is going on and giving analysis and be on record as to what took place and what our response is. Giving voice to the voiceless is important.
Yeah, and this is Margaret Prescott just weighing in. I mean, I agree with Davey D., although I honestly have to say that in terms of the alternative conventions, you know, we haven't been there locally, much less nationally in the way that we are right now. And I do think, you know, which is something that likely we have to do something about and likely would need to change. And I know some of that sometimes is a question of resources. But I do think that we do serve our listeners by being at a place like this, by being at the DNC and bringing some alternative voices and some alternative points of views. I mean, there's a difference when I go and talk to Republican women, for example, than when a reporter from CNN goes and talks to Republican women. I mean, we could be talking with the same set of women and, you know, different things would come out. So I think that it is news. People that I work with who live in the global south, who live in Europe, said, listen, right now you all are choosing the leader of the so-called free world, except we don't have any choice in the matter. This is very, very serious business, because mm-hmm. a lot of the policies that happen right here in Washington, D.C., we do pay the price for them here in the United States. But you know who pays the highest price? People who are the most impoverished in the world. So people who are in Haiti, who are in the Caribbean region, across the continent of Africa, in Latin America, they are going to be paying the highest price for what goes on right here at the RNC and at the DNC. And we do have a responsibility, I think, to bring some alternative voices, to give some analysis and put it within not only the local and national context, but the global context as well.
So if finally, as you're there reporting at the Republican National Convention in Tampa Bay, both from Pacifica stations, and you'll probably then journey on to the DNC. We look forward to hearing more from you there. Many people would argue that what we're seeing now, if the Republican Party is victorious in November, that it will make a difference between Republican and Democrat. Others argue it makes no difference. I'm curious, just taking out from what you both have said, do you think there's a difference? Do you think it makes a difference in terms of what the American people see and what they end up doing in November, Davey D., and then off to Margaret?
I reject the notion. It sounds cute when people say they're all the same.
Yeah, right.
I don't think they are. And I think when you're able to say that, I don't think you're being intellectually honest. There's a difference, even though there's a lot of common commonality in them. I liken it to this. There are prisons, some are country club prisons, and some are hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're still prisons at the end of the day. So we live in an empire at the end of the day, yes. There's still corporate dominance, but you put these guys in motion, and there's going to be some very real immediate crisis that you're going to have to deal with, you know, starting with the personhood amendments and the ending of food stamps and people looking at you and saying, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps as they take away any and all resources immediately. And that's something that we need to take into account. It might not happen as quickly on the other side, so at least you give yourself a little bit of time. Where it really shows up is on the local side. Because many people may have thought at one point in time it didn't make a difference, they stayed home. As the district attorney gets elected into office who's in the same alignment as the head of the ticket, as the judges start to take seats who are also elected. And then these are folks that impact our day-to-day lives. I know in Oakland there was a judge that was getting ready to be reelected who wanted to start a special court that would have been disastrous for many of the people who were black and brown. People got wind of it, and they were able to get rid of him. That's where I think things come into play, and that's why we need to pay attention from top to bottom. Right now, keeping our eyes on the top of the ticket, that's the illusion, and that's where people kind of go there all the same. There might not be much difference between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on a lot of economic policies and even foreign policies, so to speak. But all those people that are riding on their coattails, there's a world of difference, and that's why you have to be involved. Even if it doesn't directly infect you, it's going to affect those other people that don't have voices, and that's why, I think you have to be in the game and play it to win, not just for you, but for your community that you feel you're advocating for.
Margaret?
Yeah, I agree with Davey D's point. I mean, to me, it's really a level of restraint versus no restraint. And looking at what is happening here at this RNC, I mean, this is like a huge party for the 1% and their boots on the ground. And the boots on the ground happen to be some working class and some middle class folks who really are involved with this against their own self-interest, but nevertheless, here we are. But the kinds of proposals we see in the convention platform about a fetus, being a person and therefore should have 14th Amendment rights extended to it, the kinds of draconian measures in relation to immigration policy. I mean, what the order coming from President Obama, and you saw like lines and lines of young undocumented youth really trying to take advantage of that opportunity. They're talking about repealing that and building a longer, stronger wall. Whatever the heck it is. I mean, just in about every area, you see the stamp of austerity. You see the little racist undertones of the message. I mean, the ad that they're putting out, that's a lie on Obama doing away with the workfare requirements under welfare reform. A lot of us wish that he would, but he didn't, okay? And it's a blatant lie, and it's the most popular ad that they're running right now. Rick Santorum went on about that last night. They are openly lying, okay? They are unrestrained, and that's the difference between them and the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party, they know that they, in order to keep their base a little bit happy, that they have to have a little bit of restraint, even if, they may agree on some of these things, as Davey D said. So, but these people right now are unrestrained. It is some scary stuff. It is unfettered, the market unfettered in the worst possible way. And as I said, people around the world are going to pay the price for it.
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I want to thank both of you. This is Margaret Prescott, is host and producer of Sojourner Truth on KPFK in Los Angeles, California. David E., host of Hard Knock Radio on KPFA in Berkeley, California. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Have a good one.
You too. You're listening to Beyond the Spin. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Don't go away, because after this short break, we'll be headed to Rhode Island and then to Michigan to speak with our next guests. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner for Beyond the Spin. We're about to talk to Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, who is co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Rhode Island. He's also an OBGYN at Women and Infants Hospital at Brown University, and a professor at Brown University in Rhode Island. And Pablo Rodriguez, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So before I ask a bit about the community in Rhode Island, we kind of talked a moment before we start our conversation. I think it's important to lay out there in a second that, you know, when many people across America talk about the Latino vote, they think of a monolith. You speak Spanish, you must be of the same culture, but that's far from
the truth. Well, that is a very common mistake, Mark. And as I told you before, people think that we are a monolith nationally. I don't think we are a monolith even in a single town. Latinos represent a number of countries all throughout Latin America. And even the language that we speak sometimes is a little bit different. So myself, being a host of a radio show here at Latino Public Radio, I have to be specifically concerned about even the language I use to make sure that I appeal to all the different communities that constitute the Latino community.
And who is the Latino community in Rhode Island?
In Rhode Island, the largest groups are Puerto Rican, Dominicans, Colombians, Guatemalans, and some people from South America, from Bolivia and Peru. So it's a very, very diverse community, not dominated by a single group like in other towns throughout the United States. It's also a very young community. Most of us have come here in the last 30 years. Therefore, we share a common origin, so to speak, in Rhode Island.
So one of the things we've been covering in this election cycle, this presidential election cycle, is how this election speaks or does not speak to the communities with whom we work in our broadcasting areas, in our local communities, our community radio stations. I'm curious how that plays out in Rhode Island. I mean, because, you know, many people we talk to in different communities and African-American communities and many of the Mexican-American communities, they're not voting, or some of them are for Obama, or some of them just think we're all this tied up in knots and they're not who you're voting for because who's answering our questions. How does all that play out in Rhode Island with your community?
I think that's a very important point. And the problem with communicating with the Latino community is that, unfortunately, many of the messages that are being delivered are, again, with that thought of a monolithic community. And the message really needs to be very, very individual, depending on what part of the country you are, depending on the makeup of the local Latino communities, if you want to be successful. I think the other problem that people encounter is that they think that all they need to do is translate their materials into Spanish, or, you know, getting a commercial that was designed for English-speaking audiences and translating it into Spanish, and that accomplishes the task, when in reality, all the messages need to be culturally as well as linguistically appropriate in order for people to respond to them.
So, I mean, how have people been responding to this election, do you think? I mean, there was an interesting poll we've talked about over the last couple of weeks on this program, and we'll do some more again next week, put out by Suffolk University, of unlikely voters. And one of the things the poll said of those unlikely voters, both registered and unregistered, that some 43% might vote for Obama, 23% were looking for independent or third parties, and only 14% for Romney. And, of course, many of those people who are in those polls are younger. They're communities of color. And so I'm curious how you think that plays out in your own community.
In the Latino community, this is one of the most acute problems that we have, and that is political participation anywhere from registering to vote and then getting the vote out among those that are registered to vote. To give you an example, in 2010, when we had the record number of Latinos coming out to vote, 10 million Latinos showed up at the polls nationwide. That only represented 50% of eligible voters. When the mainstream community, 66%, 65% of African American voters come out, eligible voters come out to vote. So we have a problem of registration and then of participation. And today we are facing a real, real crisis simply because many in the Latino community feel that the political process has not benefited them at all. And the anti-immigrant rhetoric of the Republican Party, plus the lack of accomplishment by the Obama administration, who promised in the first 100 days that they were going to create a new immigration pathway for undocumented workers in the United States, was not accomplished. So people are disillusioned on the Democrat side, and even those that are Republican Latinos feel alienated by their party as well. So participation by Latinos is going to be crucial, but unfortunately, I have a feeling that it's going to be greatly reduced.
Even you think it'll be less than it was? Even pardon me, it'll be
I have a feeling that it's going to be less than hoped. The numbers are pretty clear in terms of how many people are registering to vote. In the United States right now, 21 million Latinos are eligible to vote in November, and so far only 10 million are registered to vote.
And that's reflected in your community as well in Rhode Island.
Absolutely. And this is nationwide, so in some local races, the conditions get even worse. For example, in Colorado, which is expected to be one of the most contested states in November, in 2010, only 114,000 of a potential 455,000 Latinos turned out. And right now, Latino Decisions, which is a group that measures these numbers, showed a 47% of eligible voters are registered today. So as you can see, registration is only 50%, and then participation is 50% of that. So it becomes a real issue for a community that is very, very young and that needs its point of view expressed in a more effective way.
So, I mean, it leads to a couple of questions. You watch what's going to happen over the next several days and it's happening at the Republican National Convention in Tampa. And they are bringing out Marco Rubio to speak. They're bringing out the wife of the governor of Puerto Rico to speak and bringing out a number of kind of what would be considered the Republican Latino stars to speak to the nation. Does that have an effect on the community in the Dominican, Puerto Rican, Guatemalan communities in Rhode Island?
This is just decoration for the Republican convention. The platform of the Republican Party just approved a number of measures that are clearly designed to create hardship in the immigrant communities in the United States. They have actually included E-Verify nationwide, that all employers in the United States need to verify the immigration status of their workers. They have included a measure in the platform that eliminates federal funding of universities that, with their own funds, are providing in-state tuition for children of undocumented workers, you know, the dreamers, the kids that are that were brought here as children, that graduated from local schools, and that are now eligible to become university graduates, paying in-state tuition. If your university is doing that today, the Republican Party platform is saying that they will eliminate federal funding for those universities. Kris Kobach, which is the Secretary of State for Kansas, and is the author of the anti-immigration laws in Arkansas, in Nevada, in all these other states where they're in Arizona, he hijacked the entire process and included all these measures that are completely anti-immigrant and that is offensive to Latinos who are not, if you're a voter, you're not undocumented yourself, but you know someone, you have people in your family, and you know these are people that are part of your community and that are contributing. So Republicans are, in essence, shooting themselves in the foot. Maybe not in this election, but I can tell you that as time goes by and Latinos become more involved in the political process, the Republican Party is not going to be a party that is going to be welcoming them.
So how have the I'm curious because we've seen this around the country and talked to people around the country and here in our home base in Baltimore with a lot of the kids that we are now called Dreamers. How have the Dreamers reacted in Rhode Island? Have they come out en masse to take advantage? Are they being vocal? Is there a movement among them? What's happening with the Dreamers in Rhode Island?
In Rhode Island, we were very lucky. We had a board of governors, which is the governing board for higher education, approved the measure for the students to get in-state tuition, and a number have already come out to apply and to take advantage of this. So there's been, you know, there's a group of students that has been working on this for many, many years, and there's a lot of support in the community for this to happen. Again, like in every community, there's a small minority of very loud legislators that want to make an end run into the decisions of the Board of Governors and try to outlaw the practice. And like I said, the Republican Party put it in the platform. We're going to take away federal funds if you dare to give in-state tuition to undocumented students.
Is there a referendum in Rhode Island around the DREAM Act?
No, there's no referendum in Rhode Island yet. But that is one of the things that some of the anti-immigrant legislators are trying to promote.
So again, you think that the participation will be down, and I wonder, what are the issues you think that are not being, beyond the immigration issue, what are the issues in your community in Rhode Island do you feel are not being spoken to from either of the major parties, maybe even the third parties?
Well, the main problem that people face is that they have put all politicians in the same place. Mm. In other words, come the elections, a lot of promises are made, and then those promises are not kept. The most famous promise is Obama's promise that in the first 100 days I am going to be sending to Congress immigration reform that is going to be comprehensive and that is going to, you know, fix all the problems that ail the immigrant communities in this country. People heard that promise. People believed in that promise. And people acted on that promise by coming out to vote en masse. And 3 years later, we get the executive order of deferred deportation for the Dreamers, for the students that were brought here against their will or when they were young and graduated from high school in the United States. This order comes 3 years too late because this community is well informed. We do know that that capacity was within the reach of the president 3 years ago, and yet we waited 3 years. We waited 3 months before the election to make this kind of promise. I think people become tired of being promised to and not delivered.
We want to thank Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, who is co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Rhode Island, where he hosts the daily show Nuestra Salud and Saturday programs Hablemos and Cuatro Poder. And Pablo Rodriguez, it's been great to have you with us. Thank you so much for all your time.
Great to join you.
This is Mark Steiner, and welcome back to Beyond the Spin. Levi Rickard is editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Native News Network. And Levi, welcome. Good to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here, Mark.
So what do you think are the biting issues? I mean, I know that when we talked earlier, you said you'd, you know, run an urban center in a city, a Native urban center. You've visited reservations across the country. So the issues might not be the same always, or maybe some of them are similar between urban and rural. But I wonder what you think are the most profound things that are affecting people in the Native world that are or are not being spoken to by either major party.
Well, I really think it comes down to as I think it was Bill Clinton won his election on jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, we still have reservations in the United States where there are 70% and higher American Indians who are unemployed. So that is a significant problem. And I know I was part of a telephone press conference where Secretary of the Interior Salazar was making an announcement about some renewable energy. And my question was, how does it? It all sounds great. You come into the Indian or onto Indian land, and you go ahead and do this renewable energy, and you say you're spending millions of dollars. How does it get down to the everyday Indian who needs a job? And you know, he said, well, that's what we really wanted to, how it to happen. But you know, the sad reality, Mark, it doesn't always happen that way. It's the big contractors who make the money, and I really think that the federal government really needs to figure out how does it get down to the Indian who are suffering with high unemployment rates, and subsequently, you know, if you don't have good jobs, you're going to have poor housing, you're going to have poor health, and you know, you may not even be able to afford a good education because this is a big, ugly cycle. So we really need someone to really pay attention to those four issues, really, employment, housing, health, and education.
So when you look at states like places, let's say, like Arizona, or and maybe to a lesser extent places like Montana and Wyoming and New Mexico, where in Washington State, where the native vote could play a pivotal role.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we've talked to other people around the country in native broadcast stations across the country and community stations is that the battle for them is even getting people to want to come out to vote.
That's correct. I think there's so much apathy, you know, there's so much mistrust, distrust that has been historic, and that's one of the things that the Native News Network, we tried to work closely with the National Congress of the American Indians and like President Jefferson Keel, when he did his State of the Tribal Nations in D.C. earlier this year. He stated, like, there's last election cycle, there are 1 million American Indians unregistered to vote. So it really starts with Indians need to get registered. So we're trying to work with them on that and get the publicity out. You know, given everything that's happened with American Indians historically, you know, I think it's easy to understand why they mistrust politicians, the federal government, et cetera. However, There is an area that Indians have always come to the table, so to speak, and that deals with the U.S. military. We historically have participated at higher levels on a percentage-wise basis than any other racial ethnic group in the United States. So I've been talking to some people. I said, why don't we get our veterans who are willing to go die in the name of the flag to, once they're home, use them as ambassadors and say, tell our people, you need to go vote. You know, if they're willing to die for it, that should be the easy part. Now that they're home, stateside, go out and you know, get to the young people, get to the maybe even elders who just said, hey, you can't trust either party. But I really do think that we have to have a voice. Native people have to have a voice, and that is one way to exercise that voice is voting. It's very, very important.
Do you see any kind of surge like that? I mean, we're watching this race, that, and I'm curious. We all look serious, excuse me, all curious how it's going to work out. Where Winona Benally Baldenegro, mm-hmm, is running to become the first Native American woman to the U.S. Congress.
She actually got beat by 64-35, and I think there's three precincts that's still not reported, and I haven't done anything with it yet, but I'm covering it. But for all practical purposes, she lost that race out there in Arizona last night.
It was last night. So, yeah, right.
The 28th, that's right.
The 28th. So what is that race, though? I mean, what does she symbolize and signify in this race? I mean, she ran as a Native American, not just a Native American, but she was a Native American woman running as a progressive Democrat, mm-hmm, in Arizona.
Well, I think it potentially could have been huge. I mean, here's a lady who is very accomplished in that she has a law degree from Harvard. I want to say she has, and we've covered her, and I'd have to go back to the story, but I think two master's degrees and very, very intelligent young lady. There again, I'm not quite sure why the Native vote wasn't mobilized enough to put her over the top. You know, that that's something that we will spend a lot of time on this year in terms of trying to get that native vote out. And I wrote a commentary in her favor last week, and it's just not enough. I mean, it's just, and I think we need to get somehow. I don't know if we get everybody in the room. Exactly. I say that almost with a little humor, but somehow we have got to convince people to get out and vote for native people. And some of the tribes with the casino dollars, they need to get behind these native candidates, because I don't care what anyone says, it takes money to win elections. We may not like how the game is played, but if we're going to play it, we've got to do it the way the non-natives do it, and it really comes down to dollars. And as we have seen and heard, you know, there are some U.S. senators that basically have said, hey, I've had enough of this, because as soon as I get elected, I have to start working towards re-election and, you know, spending a third of my time or whatever, trying to get contributors for the next time. She just was not. I think she was outspent like about 8-1 or something. I think some of the last numbers I saw. So I think it really comes down to dollars. And we have got to collectively, Native people have got to come together and say, we've got to figure out a way to raise the dollars. Because it really, you know, in the modern age of technology with the internet and television and everything else, you've got to be able to go buy those television commercials. And as much as we all hate those commercials, you know, they do work.
Do you see a surge from the ground up anywhere, like for local races where younger, even older Native people are running for city council in urban places like Minneapolis or L.A. or Seattle or in out west anywhere or literally in Wyoming, New Mexico, Arizona, where people are running on a local level to try to make a dent?
Well, you know, I think that in some cases, like we have Congressman Tom Cole, and he's a Republican from Oklahoma, and you know, he's a very nice man. I mean, I sat down in his congressional office earlier this year, but it strikes me he was so, how can I say, he really got tied up, really became progressive. You know, for what Winona tried to do, go from being basically an unknown among non-natives to becoming a candidate to run for Congress, you've got to have the bucks to get your name out there. Mr. Cole, on the other hand, he had started out, I want to say, as a county commissioner. He had worked his way up to state senator, and he had had numerous positions within the Republican Party. So you really, in a sense, have to get over the fear of politics, so to speak, and get involved with the party and be willing to start at the ground up and work all your way up. And I really think that's been my observation, actually. Is just, you really got to start at the lower rung and just keep you working your way up.
We've been talking with Levi Rickert. He is editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Native News Network. And Levi Rickert, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for taking your time with all of us today.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
That's all we have time for today, and I'd like to thank all of our guests this hour. Margaret Prescott, host and producer of Sojourner Truth on KPFK in Los Angeles, California. David D., host of Hard Knock Radio on KPFA in Berkeley, California. Levi Rickert, editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Native News Network, who joined us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Dr. Pablo Rodriguez, co-founder and president of Latino Public Radio in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks to Mike Knight for engineering for us at WEAA in Baltimore, and also to Ronaldo Almonte for engineering at Latino Public Radio. I'm your host, Mark Steiner, in Baltimore, Maryland, where I host The Mark Steiner Show at WEAA, a public radio station based at Morgan State University. And thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Spin. Please join us again next week. Beyond the Spin is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and WEAA, produced in association with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Our producer is Justin Levy. Our engineer at Center for Emerging Media is Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Thin Cuts. Please contact us with your thoughts and ideas, feedback, questions, or suggestions for Beyond the Spin at beyondthespin@gmail.com or facebook.com/beyondthespin, or go to steinershow.org. You can hear a podcast of today's show. And for Beyond the Spin, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-6000. 7555.